session number 21564, reel 30.
Colonel Cormac, reel 13. Your next posting after being at Mons for 3 years was to Cyprus. What were you doing there?
Well, I was posted out to join 37 Field Engineer Regiment, which was based in just outside Limassol, as a second in command of one of the field squadrons there. And at that time, we were getting near, hopefully, the end of the emergency caused by the movement for Enosis, that's union with Greece, and the activities of Colonel, self-styled General Grievous. And it was really just a basic internal security operation at that time, on the old style, and I think I quoted Gwynne's Imperial Policing, and that was how we based our operations. We were mostly involved in cordon and search operations, looking for hides and caches of arms and weapons, which were dumped at various places all around the island. And my first year, our regiment was involved in that sort of thing. As a squadron second in command, I had a small part to play in operations, but basically it was the administration running the squadron while the boys were out, but occasionally had a flavour of that. The effect of that situation was a very restricted social life. There was a curfew on, and if you went out, if you had time to go out socially, you were always armed with our rather ineffective 3.8 pistols that we had, and you had to look after those very carefully because they were prime targets for terrorists. And hosts and hostesses used to say that here's the table in the hall behind the locked door, please leave your guns here. Had a slightly Wild West connotation to it in some respects. If the party was likely to be a good one and last longer, the host and hostess would arrange beds or mattresses, and people slept there and then went home when curfew was lifted the next day. It didn't necessarily lead to a riotous social life. It was just the way things were. That was one effect, but you had to be careful. There were beautiful beaches all around Cyprus, ideal for holidaying and sunbathing, as people know now. The selected beaches that we used for swimming were cordoned off with barbed wire and patrolled with armed guards, which gave us slightly, again, artificial air to one's life.
Was the accommodation behind the wire? Was there a perimeter around the accommodation in which you were living?
Well, our camp at Polymedia had a perimeter fence, and we shared the camp. It was split in two with the battalion of the Green Jackets and the infantry role, and we as a sappers were half infantry, half sappers. And that was secure, and we had guards all around, patrols. The perimeter fence was checked regularly in the same way that our beaches. And our married quarters were not patrolled in quite the not secured in quite the same way. They were in ordinary accommodation, or in there was Polymedia village, a Berengaria village near Polymedia camp, that was protected. That had a wire fence all the way around. But many of us, when our wives were allowed to come out, were in accommodation down in the town of Limassol. So we had to that extent, take a chance. Luckily, there weren't many cases of attacks on families. But for the first 6 months of my stay there, my wife and family couldn't join me because there had been a blanket ban on family movement, as one wife had been killed in Famagusta. And the panic reaction was to stop all families coming out and this and that. It turned out that she was killed by a jealous husband or something, but that's by the way. But that was the atmosphere of the place. But it gave you a chance to get out and about, and you searched all sorts of places, partly on routine and partly on information receive from intelligence sources and partly on hunches.
I was going to ask roughly how many, you know, how frequent were these search operations and on what sort of scale?
They were on greater or lesser degree weekly. They were a constant thing, partly to look for them in earnest and partly to harass the opposition and keep them moving and on the so on. Mm. And that was our side. The infantry had perhaps the harder time. They were always patrolling out. Very difficult country. Although it's not a big island, it's quite big enough. And people who know the lay of the land can, like all guerrillas or subversives, can hide out and be concealed fairly easily. And it was a painstaking business to find them. Mm. And they were able to keep almost one jump ahead, because the local population, particularly the Greek Cypriot half, were either in favour of the grievous storm or they were completely passive. The Turkish Cypriots were more inclined to favour us, if only because we thought we might help them against the Greek Cypriots. Mm. So it was always that sort of tension going on.
Well, when you did a search, I mean, how many sappers would you normally require to search village or...
It wasn't often village searching. It was usually a specific building.
Yes.
And one has to say that an awful lot of the weapons and stuff that were actually found were found in churches and associated lands. Mm. The Greek Cypriot, the Orthodox Greek Cypriot clergy, were somewhat ambivalent, but... more inclined to favour Enosis with Greece than independence for Cyprus at that time. It wasn't until Macarius had been exiled and then in the traditional fashion brought back to head a de facto independent Cyprus that they became more neutral. But they were by and large more in favour of the Grievous's organisation.
Mm. So if you had to search a church and its dependencies and the priest's house and so on, what sort of size of team would you require to do a standard search operation?
Well, it was usually a lot more manpower intensive than what such operations became in, say, later in Northern Ireland. And it depended on the size of the place, but you had to cordon the place off.
That would be the infantry, wouldn't it, doing that?
Well, that, or if they were available, or we had to do it ourselves.
Yes.
And then the search party would go in with mine detectors or whatever. And it was always a tricky business, searching ecclesiastical property, because whatever you did, you were bound to upset the feelings of some people, whether they knew or didn't know that the place was a likely hidey hole. But the fact is that a lot of churches and graveyards, cemeteries, were in fact hiding places. Mm. I think originally they assumed that we wouldn't search those.
Were they skillful at actually concealing caches of weapons? And
fairly, yes. Mm. And the countryside overall was very much in their favour.
Mm. What about explosives? Did they have explosives as well as small arms?
Yes, they did. Didn't use too much of that, but they had them available. Mm. They're most of the incidents were hit and run. Someone would take a weapon in to Nicosia or wherever, and a carrier would take the weapon in, then it would be handed over to someone who was actually going to pull the trigger, and as soon as that had been done, the weapon was passed on to somebody else, frequently a woman, who would then conceal the weapon under her skirts and then disappear. That sort of technique was used quite a lot. There were straightforward ambushes when they would take known routes and hide up in the rocks around. One of our chaps got a George Medal for his vigorous reaction to an ambush when he grabbed his unreliable Sten gun and counterattacked virtually and sent the ambushers on their merry way, and some of them not rejoicing. So that was a technique they used too. That was by chance that we got involved in that one. That was most of the infantry that would be countering. And then their explosives they used to make improvised devices for mining roads, particularly in the hilly area, which there's a lot in Cyprus. And our problem was how to clear those roads, which were used regularly by our transport for administrative and operational purposes. And we spent a lot of time trying to counteract that by mine-clearing devices mounted in the front of Land Rovers and other vehicles to avoid that. So there were very few stand-up fights. It was either the assassination, more or less carefully planned. It would be the ambush situation. It would be the blowing up of columned vehicles on mountain roads, which tended to have steep cutaway sides, that would cause the most damage. Pinpricks of that nature, that were the operation of the day in say, late 58, early 59, that I can recall.
One of the difficulties with searches is that searching often involves doing a considerable amount of material damage.
Yes.
And this can affect the morale of troops, particularly if they do the damage and they don't find anything, because there was never anything there in the first place, or it had been removed in advance. Did you run into any difficulties of that sort?
As far as one could, particularly with ecclesiastical property, was that you tried to do it with the minimal damage, and then you would do your best to restore it afterwards, particularly if you found nothing. The information we got wasn't always reliable, naturally enough, and you followed many false chases. But if it was out in the country and you didn't find anything, well, that was, you could knock it around a hole in the hillside as much as you like. But buildings, one would tend to try and minimize the damage or do something to sort, a token gesture to sort it out afterwards. But so much of it was negative. You went out and you searched and you checked and cleared areas without result. But that's part of the routine of internal security operations.
How would you conduct such an operation? Presumably you went out on some of these cordon and search operations. You weren't always behind mining the shop.
Yeah, I didn't often do it. I had to rely on what people were saying when they came back in. But basically, you would try and choose it at a most inconvenient time for them, or a time that they might not expect to. But it was always very difficult when the local population were either passive or against you to move anywhere without the word getting around that you were coming. And that's why so often things that were smallish things that were hidden could be removed before you got there. Mm. But basically, you just had a plan to get out fairly early, and you cordoned the area off before you moved in. And then you went to either a general search or particular aspects, like certain tombs or graves or altars or church towers, that the report was that you might find something. And I said that they were very fond of using ecclesiastical property for storing things, because apart from those in the villages, the monasteries were all at the end of fairly long mountainous roads, and your approach could be signaled well in advance. So there was method in that. But once we got used to the idea that they were doing that, then we had no hesitation in going in to search. Because in the early days, I can well imagine that they were a bit doubtful about charging into St. Paul's Cathedral or Westminster Abbey to search for terrorist weapons, if you can forgive the analogy.
Were you also looking for certain personalities? You mentioned General Grivas.
He was the prime target.
But did you get deployed at any stage on cordon or sweep operations to try and
roadblocks and known movement areas? Yes. What we did have was everyone, or all of us in sort of positions who were had a handbook of the wanted men. And that was Grievous and his lieutenants and other senior people in the IOCA organization. And they were there with a brief description and, where possible, a photograph. And they were key figures to try. And if you could arrest those, that was a major coup, because it would upset their organization quite considerably. We used to take it in turns to look after Kyrenia Castle, which was a very significant place in, just in North Cyprus, now in Turkish hands. That castle was easily defended by us, and it contained several interesting things. It had a huge arsenal of rifles and shotguns that had been confiscated at the beginning of the thing and during it. There was amnesties. Please hand all your weapons in. This is the best way to get peace and so on. And it was quite interesting that that huge arsenal there, full of these weapons, were all in apple pie condition. They were looked after and maintained and oiled properly all the time until they were to be handed back. It was a curious little sideline. But down in the dungeons of the great castle were the old Crusader dungeons. And there, many of them had been converted into cells to hold the known terrorists and other terrorists that we had identified and captured while awaiting trial. So it served as an arsenal for confiscated weapons and a prison for those we were lucky enough to catch.
What sort of weapons did the squadron find when it went on its searches? You know, were they...
A huge range of different things, from the early wars between Greece and Turkey, before and after World War One, to other operations. It was just a mishmash of rifles, shotguns, antique weapons. No set pattern to them. A lot of very fine shotguns, because Cyprus was a very good area for rough shooting. Some rifles, because there were those who hunted deer or mountain goats, I think were fairly popular. That sort of thing, a wide range of weapons. And World War II weaponry that had got lost and found its way into their hands. And some who had been armed by us that during World War II served in the British Army during World War II, who kept their weapons. That was a sort of wide range of... of kit that could be around.
Did you find any supplies of modern military weapons that might have been brought in from Greece? Or
not that I can recall, but I would suspect that because there was a certain amount, or more than a certain amount of support from Greece itself, that modern weaponry would have found its way across, but I don't recall any. They weren't... Again, as far as I know, in the habit of using things like mortars, artillery didn't come into it. It was rifles, machine guns of the Sterling, Sten gun, Thompson submachine gun type of thing that would be found. Because which were only used on the ambush type situation that I described. Sure. The most of the targets were individual British officers or political officers who would be assassinated. That was one of their favourite techniques, which I mentioned earlier.
Were there any attacks on your camp or quarters, any major incidents while you were there?
Yeah, not on the barracks as such, but the Berengaria village, which was a prefabricated village, sort of substandard houses, was protected. It had its own nappy shop and club. That was blown up and burned down. There was an Afi-type compound they ran the canteens inside the barracks, and there was a shopping centre there, the usual things. They were damaged slightly, and sad to say, they all bugged out and left us with our nappy clubs and canteens inside the barracks without anything. And it's an enormous credit of our old Indian Army followers, the Charwala group, the tailors and others, who came along and said, we will run your canteen for you. And they did, in a fairly primitive and not altogether hygienic way, but at least they kept the thing going, provided hot meals. So with masses of chips, slightly different from the cookhouse stuff. And they provided a tailoring service, in the old traditional way. Rather sadly, when things quietened down, the nappy insisted on coming back and booting them all out. But that was just, I didn't rate that too highly. But those are the sort of major things that affected our camp area.
You mentioned making searches which were directed by intelligence. Where did this intelligence come from to you?
Well, informers. There were not everyone agreed with...
But, I mean, did this come to you directly?
Oh, no.
The squadron?
No,
what was the route by which it got to you?
It didn't come to me direct until later, when I was in intelligence later on.
Yes.
These were reports which the local intelligence corps company, they were there doing intelligence gathering and interrogating people that we'd caught, field security sections and the like. And they had their own network of agents, informers, with varying degrees of reliability. And they would pass the information to the operational headquarters, who would then target us. And we would be tasked to go and do this based on that sort of information. Or it would be a routine thing. It's their turn to be searched if nothing else was coming up. So the pressure was always kept on them.
But the idea of maintaining an intrusive presence, was that behind the searches directed?
Not to infiltrate, but to keep them, to harry them, to not allow them peace, to keep them moving, which meant that they would have to disperse their caches of weapons more widely and therefore perhaps leave them more easily for us to find. That was the idea. It didn't always work, but you had to keep the pressure on, I think, was the way, and not allow them to have a free hand, and certainly not to be seen to allow them to have a free hand to wander at will. You had to keep the thing going.
How did the population of an area that was being searched react normally when you turned up and announced what you were going to do?
Mostly neutral. Occasionally you got some brave people who would be slightly hostile or vigorously hostile, shouting or throwing stones, but mostly they were neutral and apathetic about it.
Did you ever contemplate getting involved in dealing with large-scale public disorder, with riots or anything of that sort?
Those who were involved in the area around Nicosia had more chance to experience controlling rioting crowds. I don't recall, certainly in my time in Limassol, there weren't many disturbances of that nature. When, although we practiced, we would have formed up in the old drill with a clear formation, with a shorthand typer, a shorthand writer, a bugler to give the warning calls, the local magistrate there with his riot act, a big banner saying disperse or we fire and so on, and we had all that, which we later on used in the early days in Ireland until we realised that was pretty futile. But we started off controlling crowds in the way that we had learned in India or the Indian subcontinent and elsewhere. But that gradually died out. And
you didn't actually use that yourself with your sappers?
No. I did as infantry in Ireland to begin with, but that's another story.
What sort of relations did you have with the police?
Oh, a very close working relationship with the police. The Cyprus police were very similar to the Palestine police and the Hong Kong police. I can remember going back many years when I joined the army first, having a talk by the Palestine police who came round on a recruiting team, and they said, "Come and join the police in Palestine." Very exciting life, worthwhile, quick promotion, good pay. And indeed it was, and I think one or two were attracted. A lot of police from the UK went out to join those forces because they could become inspectors and superintendents at the rate of knots. And they were a very tough, hard bunch. When the Palestine mandate closed in 48, majority of them came to join the Cyprus police. They were well used to that sort of situation, and they were a very tough bunch indeed, verging on the ruthless, I would say. And they had their own police stations and the interrogation centres, and I don't think it's untrue to say that they were pretty vigorous, and they're a means of extracting information from people.
I was going to ask you if you got intelligence direct from them.
We wouldn't, again. That would go. The liaison between headquarters Cyprus and the police was pretty good, and they would pass on what they felt was useful to us.
So it was liaison at command level,
oh, yes.
And not horizontal?
No, we would know our local police, but I don't think we got very much from them. But if we had to do anything, we would have to tell them we were doing it. And they would probably know anyway that we were out. Mm. So there was a working relationship. The flow of intelligence as such was at the top level.
To go up and then down again.
Yeah. Mm.
Did they have a special branch organisation?
Yes, they did. Yes, they did. Mm. I don't know too much about it, but they had a special branch, yes. And they would have their own network of informers. Mm. Because the police officers were all, 90% British. But the ordinary Cypriot policeman would be a Cypriot. Mm. Yeah, but they were really they worked pretty well. I think there was no quite where their loyalties lay. Mm. There weren't many Turkish Cypriots in the police.
Did you often or ever go into Turkish areas to go searching for arms, or were you exclusively concerned with the Greek Cypriots?
But by the very nature of the movement, there wasn't much to do in the Cyprus, in the Turkish Cypriot quarters. All the time, there was continual friction, and there always had been, between the Greek and Turkish Cypriot communities. And some of it was particularly violent. I mean, Greek Cypriot villages would get burned down and people massacred. Turkish Cypriot villages would get burned down and massacred. Those things happened. Pretty regularly. The relationship between the two communities was not good. But the Turkish Cypriots tended to look to us for protection more than the Greek Cypriots. Parallels with Northern Ireland are not hard to find. Mm. But they were pretty brutal to each other.
During this year or so you had with 37, with the squadron, did you get the impression that you were making progress and that you were having a positive impact on the level of enemy activity and violence? Or was it the other way round? Did you think that you were not containing the level of enemy activity and violence?
I would rate the success fairly low. I think containing, keeping certain areas trouble-free, was about as much as we could hope for. It was an almost impossible situation. We could hold and contain and have the odd success, but at the end of the day, all these situations have to be resolved politically. They have to be, and indeed it was in the end. After Macarius was released from the Seychelles, where he'd been sent to exile, back he came, and then negotiations and a peace was declared.
And did you have any foreknowledge or suspicion that was likely to happen? Were you in touch with the sort of grand political development?
Not at my level. Mm. It was rumour and counter-rumour. One never knew until it actually happened that it was going to. We thought it might, we hoped it might. Then there were setbacks. Now, at our level, we didn't have much idea how much progress was being made. And indeed, when progress was made, we weren't really sure how it would hold. Because when Lord Grievous faded from the scene, there were some of his lieutenants, I think Nicholas Sampson was one, who was particularly brutal terrorist, had a very senior post in the provisional government, but his role, the chances of him keeping his word and behaving rationally were pretty small. I've got a feeling that he was assassinated. I can't be sure. I think he was murdered later. More or less by his own side, or whatever. But the sort of characters that came up through the Grievous's EOCA organisation were not those naturally suited to run civil authority. Macarius could, I mean, he had